And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I'm here live, and I hope you'll call in and let me know that you're here live, too. Have you ever gotten something so good, but you knew that it didn't have to happen that way, and you had to sort of pinch yourself, and you weren't sure? You know, like you've got a good grade in school, but you wanted to make sure that it was the right grade, or maybe you heard that, I don't know, your mom and dad had some good news for you, and you thought you knew what it was, and you weren't quite sure. Have you ever had something where, you know, you find something or hear something that sounds too good to be true and you're nervous about it? Well, that's how I feel. That's how I feel right now. There's no reason to complain. The polls are wonderful. And for somebody like me, and I got to tell you, a month before Election Day, I am a wreck. I am looking at 6, 7, 8, 10 different poll sites every single day. And, they're good. They're good. Nationwide, we have Barack Obama at least 5 points, more likely 6 or 7 points. Some polls, including the notable Gallup poll, have him as high as 8 points. State by state, he's doing excellently. I had said long ago that I think he needed Colorado to win, but he could also win with Virginia or Ohio. Well, right now, Obama's ahead in Colorado and Virginia and Ohio and Florida and Nevada. And in fact, depending on which poll you read, in some polls he's ahead in North Carolina and Missouri, traditional Republican states, and he's nipping at the heels in Indiana, a state that hasn't gone Democratic since, I think, Lyndon Johnson in 1964? And yet, I'm nervous. I'm afraid to even tell you this. Now, I know many of you know it's true. You may not realize how good it is. But I'm afraid to tell you because the election isn't over. And if we allow one moment to rejoice, one moment to take out the champagne, one moment to be complacent, it could all be over in a flash. Now, I live in the state of Virginia. I'm in the Washington, D.C. area. I am within the Beltway. The Beltway goes into Virginia. In fact, I'm in the part of Virginia that used to be part of the District of Columbia. So I feel very, very close to Washington, which is 5 minutes away from me. But at least living in Virginia, I get a vote that counts, a major vote. And that's really cool for me. And I got to say, all of us Americans in swing states, we're feeling pretty important right now. Probably like the citizens of Iowa and New Hampshire feel at the beginning of the primary season. It's completely unfair. Oh, don't get me wrong. The Electoral College is a joke. Maybe it made some sense 200 and some odd years ago. It certainly makes no sense today. So I'm not saying it's fair. But, you know, I lived in California for a number of years. My vote didn't count much there. You know, I went to school in Massachusetts and Connecticut. Your vote in Massachusetts is meaningless. If your vote in Massachusetts matters, ooh, you're losing in a landslide. In fact, actually, I was in Massachusetts when Walter Mondale lost in a landslide and even lost Massachusetts to Ronald Reagan. But no, I live in Virginia. And if you live in Virginia or Colorado or Ohio or Florida or Missouri or Nevada or even Indiana or North Carolina or New Hampshire, maybe you're a special citizen. You get to decide the presidential election. Now, you know, Pennsylvania still matters and Wisconsin and Minnesota, too. Heck, even Bob and Agnes Kincaid's home state of West Virginia, that's next on the list, I got to say. I mean, to me, this is like toppling dominoes, and I've watched. First, we had to conquer Colorado, and we did. Then we had to conquer Virginia, and we did. Then we had to conquer Florida, and we did. Then Ohio. Then Nevada. Then next in line was North Carolina, followed quickly by Missouri. Those two are still on the fence. Our next battle is Indiana. But you know what? After Indiana, that gets us to 375 electoral votes. The next battle would be West Virginia. Yes, West Virginia, the state that went overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton. I think more or as much, I don't want to say more, as much an anti-Obama vote as it was a pro-Clinton vote. Listen, economic times are hard. And people are hurting. And we are in the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. And it's likely to get worse. And so, you know, you can't be really happy. And yet I know and you know, that the reason why Barack Obama is doing so well is precisely because George Bush drove our country into the toilet. And I know that I know times are hard, and I know people are struggling to get by, and I know how hard it is. People are losing their jobs, unemployment's going up, and what's the government doing? Well, they're doing all they can do. They're printing money right and left. And I don't even blame them. I understand it. You know, I do have an economics degree. I understand that you have to prime the pump. But I also understand that it has costs. Because of our massive deficit, caused by things like needless tax cuts to the rich, and yes, a very, very expensive war in Iraq, we are more in the red than, any time in my lifetime. Probably the most in debt as a percentage of our gross national product than we've been in since World War II. We're deeply in debt. Of course, in World War II, they raised taxes to pay for it. Neither candidate's going to do that. So we're in trouble. Big trouble. And it's all because of George Bush's economic policies. They are coming home to roost. And at the end of the day, what the government is doing to get us out of trouble is going to lead to massive inflation. Mark my words. Prices are going up. Unemployment's going up. Inflation's going up. It will take 2 to 3 years at best for a very good president like Barack Obama to get us out of this mess. If John McCain is president, I suspect we will have another Great Depression. And that's not just, you know, fear. It has to do with understanding who is the engine of the economy. And these are things that I've talked about many times, but it's very important to understand. Not just that it's unfair that, 5% of Americans can get 30% of the wealth, or 10% of Americans can get 50% of the wealth. It's not just that it's unfair that corporate CEOs can earn hundreds of millions of dollars for running a company into the ground. If you look at it purely economically, this cruelty, this unfairness, this idea that the middle class and the poor are left behind, this understanding that in America the average family has lost $2,000 a year, while in the Clinton years their wages went up $7,000 a year. I mean, usually every year, every decade, America does better. This is the decade, the O's, when we're worse off. They said the 70s was a period of decline. The 70s, Americans stayed even. In the O's, we lost. We lost wages. We lost debt. We lost our sense of national pride and honor. We lost our respect for the law. George Bush, Dick Cheney, and all their kin, their Republican friends in Congress, Tom DeLay and all the different, you know, Duke Cunningham and Bob Ney and Doolittle and Stevens and Don Young. I mean, virtually everyone in Alaska. The list goes on and on. The corruption takes its toll. The massive incompetence takes its toll. There's a huge cost. And we're going to have to listen to our overlords, China and Saudi Arabia and all the other people that own us. And the only silver lining to this incredible, awful crisis, and it is one, and it's so bad that, what can I say, I disagree with my good friend Bob Kincaid. I think the bailout bill is necessary, as much as I hate it. In fact, it's probably not enough to avoid real crisis. I mean, I've studied the Great Depression. I studied it as a student of history. I studied it as a history of economics. What happened in the Great Depression is people, like today, had spent too much, had overinflated too much, had bought too much, had, you know, there was a boom. But booms and busts happen all the time, right? I mean, you know, we had a little boom and a little bust in 2000. This was different. This one, for the first time since the Great Depression, there's an extreme lack of confidence in anything. Banks are failing. People are running on banks. This we have not seen since the 1930s. People are afraid to lend to anyone, even good lenders. Yes, it started because of Wall Street greed. Yes, it started because of people like George Bush and John McCain being against government regulation. Yes, it started because of all this gambling by extremely rich people, knowing that if they win, they get lots of money, and if they lose, they still get lots of money. It's called in Las Vegas a sure thing. You roll the dice, and if it lands seven, you win, and if it lands snake eyes, well, you know the guy that owns the casinos, you still win. Who loses? Well, in this case, the American people. And yet, as awful as I know it is, and as much as I want the people who've done this to suffer, and I mean suffer, I mean take every last dime from them, throw them in prison if you can, I think that homeless people living under a bridge have every right to have better lives, better homes, better food than the CEO of any of these companies. Nonetheless, I understand the need for credit. I know. Because what happened in the Great Depression is that President Herbert Hoover decided at that time he was going to raise taxes. He was going to reduce the amount of money in the system. And people ran on banks. And if you know how banks work, if you know how the economy works, you know that banks don't have every dime you put in there. Don't run on the bank. It's okay. You're FDIC insured. We'll get to that. But if there's, oh, I don't know, 100 people and each of them has $1,000 in the bank doesn't loan out $100,000. No, the bank loans out $1 million, expecting that not all 100 of you will come back and claim your money at the time. If you do, the bank fails. Because their debts are greater than their credits. And that's how banks make money, and that's okay. That's how the credit system works. What happened in the 1930s, when Herbert Hoover raised taxes and people ran on banks and people didn't trust that their money would be safe in banks, is that the money supply went way, 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 way down. Nobody could get loans for anything. Well, FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, did a number of very important things. First of all, he declared a bank holiday. He told everyone it was safe to put money in banks, and he backed it up with a organization that still existed today, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which says if you have up to $100,000, that's protected. And in fact, Congress has done the right thing by increasing that, at least temporarily. I think it should probably be permanent, to $250,000. You don't have to be super wealthy to understand that these things matter in an economy. Unfortunately, when Wall Street sneezes, Main Street does catch cold. But I think what Americans are finally understanding, and maybe it takes this kind of horrific crisis to make them understand, is that government can solve the problem. Indeed, government is the only thing that can solve the problem. Republicans love to run against government. And I'll be the first to admit that government has its share of wastefulness and its share of bureaucrats, and most Department of Motor Vehicles across the country are not the best place to be on a bright Saturday morning. But you know what? A lot of things government does works. Social Security works. Medicare works. Ask anyone on Medicare if they'd rather have a private health care plan. Go ahead, ask them. They'll tell you. It works. And it takes this kind of economic crisis for people to see that unfettered capitalism, capitalism without any restraints, capitalism without any restrictions, capitalism without any regulations, doesn't work. And if you don't believe me, read The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, and you'll see how America was in the 1890s. I am not a socialist, but nor am I a complete capitalist. You need a combination. You need government and business to work together. Democrats are moderates here. And those that support an unfettered free market are learning that it doesn't lead to wealth. It leads to greed, but not to wealth. Spike from Pennsylvania. I think that's a new caller. Spike, welcome to the show.
Gonzo Greens. I called once before when you had Bob on, I think, actually.
Okay. First time on my show, so welcome to the show.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts?
A lot of them busy around this time of day, so sometimes it's hard for me to... I'll turn it on and I'll be doing a million things so I can't call. So it's nice to have a little time today.
Well, I'm glad to hear from you. And you called in early enough to have a significant amount of time. What's on your mind?
Yeah. Well, you were talking a little bit about the bailout and saying how it was
right.
Necessary. It, there was a bailout necessary. Unfortunately, the wrong people have been bailed out.
Well, no, you can argue. Let me be clear. I'm not saying that this particular bailout was necessarily the best one that could have been done. I'm not making that argument. I'm just arguing that we need a lot more money in the economy to avoid what happened in the Great Depression, and there's only two ways to do that, monetary policy and fiscal policy. Monetarily, I assure you, the Federal Reserve is printing money as fast as they can go. We're going to pay for it later with inflation, but they are.
No.
And then you need fiscally. You need the government to pour a ton of money in the economy. That's what John Maynard Keynes said. He was right. That's the only way we got out of the Depression. Now, you can argue about where the money should go, and that's where you and I may well agree.
Yeah, well, certainly, if we really look back on history, it was, certainly the propaganda has turned it, the war effort turned the economy around, but in reality, the infrastructure.
Well, both did. Both did. I'm not going to deny the war helped America economy. It did. But the difference is that World War II, unlike Vietnam and unlike the Iraq War, was paid for. In World War II, the richest people in the United States had an effective tax rate more than 90%. Can you imagine today people complaining about 33%? It was 92%.
Well,
so we paid for it. We weren't in the kind of debt we are today.
Look at the idea, I know Nader's been mentioned, and I'm sure others have, the 0.5% tax on transactions on stocks, would pay huge sums with all these people that are constantly buying and selling. It would be such a minimal amount people would pay. And these people screaming bloody murder like, oh, well, that's a terrible idea. You know how much that'll cost? Yeah, nothing.
Here's my view, Spike. I think that the Democrats decided this was their, and I'm hopeful, I could be wrong, but that they had to get elected, that Obama was ahead. The Democrats in the Senate and in the House are ahead right now. Indeed, the Senate, they've got a minimum of 55. I think 57 or 58 is very likely, and 60 is not out of the question. If this continues, I would not be surprised that we could have the first filibuster-proof in Congress since Jimmy Carter, and the best Democratic or Republican, actually, lead in both houses of Congress since Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Which means to me this, that if the Democrats have to compromise a little bit now, because after all, their majorities are very small now, particularly in the Senate, that come January 2009, we can fix these things. We can put in the taxes we need to put in. We can punish the people who need to be punished. We can have some of the relief that we need for people out there who are suffering. I think they decided that they had to agree with the Republicans on this one, but it is my hope and prayer, and I think they will, that once the Democrats really obtain power, then they can do a lot of things that many of us have been wanting them to do for quite a long time.
Yeah, well, and trust me, it's not like I'm against working with people of other. Unfortunately, John McCain's turned it into a dirty word almost to say, bipartisan, you reached across the aisle, all that malarkey, how he puts it, when all he means is Joe Lieberman. But I'm all for doing that, to be honest.
Yep.
Working together for a united plan for the best interest of everyone. Unfortunately, the system right now is kind of rigged against that. And it's evident if you just watch C-SPAN for more than 5 minutes, you just kind of see it at work that essentially it's rigged against that right now. And in a way, a lot how just the government and the civics works is really working against us right now, creating such a partisan atmosphere.
Well, see, I think it's because we have divided government right now. I think that George Bush and Republicans ran the country for a very long time. They ran it into the ground. Indeed, they ran it below the ground into a very deep, dark hole. And now we're kind of fighting with the Republicans at the bottom of the hole. But I really feel, and again, I don't want to get complacent. Your state, Pennsylvania, is important. My state, Virginia, is important. I don't want to get complacent. But I really feel like with the election of Barack Obama and this is just as important, folks, a strongly Democratic Congress. I want you to know I've given more money to the congressional races than I have to Obama, because I think actually congressional races need my help right now more than Obama does. With all of that together, we can do things that the Democratic Party has never done. I mean, the last time we had this kind of power was in the Jimmy Carter years of the 70s, and we had a very different Democratic Party then. We had a lot of conservatives from the South still in the party in 1977. This would be the first progressive majority since Franklin Delano Roosevelt. There's a reason why I'm citing the Great Depression here. I think Obama has a chance to give this country a new deal.
Yeah, well, certainly we need a new deal. And I mean, it's
and think about what a new deal means. I mean, people forget. They just use this expression. A new deal means you take the deck and you shuffle it and you deal it out again. In other words, you get a new chance to succeed. That's a very, you know, it's a very, you could call it a socialist term, a new deal, and opponents did. But giving everybody a fair chance to get some good cards.
Well, you know, I heard the phrase recently, and it's a great one because it's so true now and always in American history. You know, whenever capitalism fails, they always need socialism to bail them out. But
right.
Socialism
well,
never fails and needs capitalism to bail it out. And this is a perfect.
Well, no, I'm going to disagree with you, Spike. I like you. You're a smart guy. But socialism can go too far, too. I think if you look at, for example, China, a country that I have a lot of problems with its totalitarian government. But one thing that I think is clear about their economic system is that they were too socialist. They were too government-run. And when they went to more capitalism, they're doing better.
They were communists. I'll give you an example.
Fair enough. I'll give you an example of democratic socialism, where I think you can go too far. I mean, I consider myself a moderate. I'm capitalist and socialist. They're both good. In Israel, it's probably the purest example I know of democratic socialism on the kibbutzim. These you probably know about these villages or towns. They're really like settlements where, and I know that I have a distant cousin actually who was raised on one. And what they do in these towns of, let's say, 500 people is each really does give according to their ability and takes what they need. You know, you have people that work in the fields, you have people that teach in the schools, you have people that cook in the kitchens, they have communal kitchens. Indeed, the old school back in the 50s and 60s in Israel, they even had communal raising of children. They all raised together in children's houses. It's the purest socialist experiment I know. Everyone worked, you know, to give to the community, and then the community provided it back for them. And what we found, at least in Israel, is that these communities are getting smaller and smaller. Fewer people are idealistic enough to continue it because people are saying, now, wait a minute. I worked really, really hard in the fields, and this guy next to me, he barely picked any, apples or not apples, they got oranges. They picked any oranges, but we all get fed the same and we all get clothed the same. That's not fair. If he's going to be lazy, I'll be lazy too. I mean, I do think socialism can go too far, but we're nowhere near that in America.
It depends on which type you're talking. If you're talking Bernie Sanders socialism, that isn't necessarily the case. But yeah.
No, but Bernie Sanders is a socialist. That's why he's not a Democrat. He is a socialist,
right.
And I'm glad we have one of them in Congress. And I like Bernie Sanders, and I like a lot of what he has to say. I just don't want to say extreme things. I am nowhere. Look, we are far too capitalist, America. We are definitely not socialist enough. You know, look at the European states that are a much better mix. I'm just trying to say that I don't want to ever say that you can't have an extreme on socialism. I think you can have extreme on either one. To me, you need a mixture of the two to make it work. You have to reward good effort. But at the same time, you have to make sure that, the rich don't get everything and that poor people don't starve and are denied an education or health care or any of the basic things like that.
Yeah, well, look at a great example if you want to look at Europe is Ireland, which, relatively speaking, socially, Ireland has been kind of ruled by the Catholic Church and is extremely conservative, yet Ireland has universal health care, a very good universal health care, and they have a booming economy. They found a way to kind of combine all different aspects into one nation, and they're probably the European nation closest to Americans, maybe politically speaking.
England.
Even they are more to the left of us. You know, we've moved too far to the right over the past 20 years.
Every European country, I believe, every Western European country is to the left of us, is more socialist than us, and has a stronger economy than we have.
Great point with Ireland is, you know, their economy has taken off and boomed, and they've become one of the most rapidly growing, economically speaking, countries in all of the world. And a great deal that could be even looked at is, you know, they're not spending the money we have to spend here. On, you know, everyone's in debt in America because of health care. Everyone's in debt for these other things. Well, Ireland, the government helped them out, and, you know, no one's in medical debt in Ireland, so they can go out and buy the fancy electronics and things like that, and their economy is flourishing as part of that. You know, the funniest thing is these laissez-faire free market capitalists, if they really believed in their rhetoric, they'd realize that if the government took care of us in certain aspects, we'd have more to spend in other places, and we wouldn't be hurting. Right? But, you know, those are just people who they see the world about as far as their arm can reach, and unfortunately, there's too much of that these days. We need people who can think ahead more progressively, look beyond, you know, feet in front of them to see what's really going on.
You know, if they really believed in free market capitalism, then they wouldn't be wanting a bailout at all. You'd have, Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson is from Goldman Sachs, right? I mean, he's from one of the very investment banks that caused this mess, and begging for the bailout. So look. I think Americans realize that this is a once in a lifetime election. It really is. Look, I wasn't around in 1960. I'm told that was a once-in-a-lifetime, a real game-changer election. But I'm looking back to 1932, even. I mean, we have a potential to really forge a progressive majority in America. And what's going to be fascinating tonight, Spike, is that I am absolutely convinced, not just based on my guesses, but also based, frankly, on what the McCain campaign has said, that John McCain is going to do everything he can tonight to take America's attention off the economy, off the Iraq war, off our massive debt, off our huge economic problems, off our huge moral problems, and he's going to make it personal. And they're going to talk about, you know, Obama once sat on a board with a guy who did terrorist things 40 years ago, and therefore he's a bad guy. That's all they can do because he's desperate and he's flailing.
Well, The people who are buying that are really, really sad. There was another show I heard driving my car today, and someone called in and quickly started referencing the Ayers thing and saying, you know, so the host said, wait, you mean to tell me that, you know, someone who's a current member of the Senate has direct ties to terrorism and is a terrorist? And the guy goes, yeah, and he goes, well, then you're an idiot. Yeah, you're part of that crazy 20% in this country. And the guy said, "I put off." He was told the truth, which is anyone who's buying that really is an idiot at this point. I mean,
you can't really choose your supporters. I mean, Obama has condemned everything that Ayers has stood for very strongly, but you know, Ayers supports him. I'm sure there are racists who give money to John McCain. In fact, one thing Paul Begala brought up on the Meet the Press just last Sunday was that McCain was on the board of an organization that has ties to another organization that's anti-Semitic and all. No, I don't think John McCain's anti-Semitic. Of course not. But he associated with people who associate with people who are. So there you go. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, if you want to think that Obama's a terrorist, if that's your claim, then say so openly. Say, I think Barack Obama supports destruction of the United States. If that's your true belief, you say it and you watch everybody laugh. But if it's not your true belief, then what are you saying? Well, he sat on the same board. He didn't choose who was on that board. I mean, are you saying that, you know, here you have a board that gives out community grants to people who are really suffering in America, and there's 25 people on the board, and you're chosen, and you're honored to be chosen, and one of those 25 has despicable policies. Are you saying, well, I'm not going to help the poor people because one of the people on the board, they believe in despicable things?
Yeah, well,
I mean that's what they're saying.
Yeah, I mean, that same logic, you could even turn around and say, well, you know, if someone was on Meet the Press the same day as Pat Buchanan, they're an anti-Semite because they were within the same airspace as Buchanan. I mean,
Pat Buchanan defends Nazis. There's no question about it.
Yeah, I mean,
Pat Buchanan is the most likable. He's the most likable Nazi defender I've ever seen. But he does.
But the sad part is, this is the same tactics that the Hannitys and the right wing talk machine used 6 years ago. You know, when people are against the war, oh, well, then you're a terror. You're for terror.
Spike, it's all they have.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same tactics. They've reached the back cover of the book, and they don't know what to do because no sequels were released, so they're very confused, and so they're going back to chapter one and trying all over again and hoping it would work. And
Spike, all they have is fear. And here's my advice for the Obama campaign. I don't know if anyone's listening. Obama campaign, if you're listening, here's my advice, and you don't have to give me credit. As soon as John McCain tonight, and he's going to start tonight because he's already announced it like a fool, at least Karl Rove kept his sleazy stuff secret. When he tonight attacks Ayers and, I don't know, he said he wouldn't go after Reverend Wright, but he might, and Redco and all this little stuff, and You know, and Obama's responding in kind with actually far more important stuff, Keating 5, where John McCain himself was accused of corruption. I think,
let alone the Bush kid,
Obama needs to run a commercial, and he needs to show Franklin Delano Roosevelt and that famous line, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." John McCain is running on fear.
Yeah, the old John McKennedy speech. John McKennedy, please. Back when he was inaugurated, you know, we all heard, you know, the phrase that, you know, has been played out that he said in that speech. But he also said in that very same speech the day he was inaugurated, you know, "Let us not negotiate out of fear, but let us not fear to negotiate either."
Right.
But to me, that's
a sub-question, an important one, and it has to do with sitting down with foreign leaders of countries that are despicable. And I agree with that. I think we have to negotiate with our enemies. I mean, negotiating with our friends is a lot easier. But to me, there's a broader point. And the reason why I want to harken back to FDR, I'd like to see more mention of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, because I think this isn't 1960. It's kind of like 1960, but it's even more like 1932. We're in an economic crisis. The government that's running it has no idea what's going on. Indeed, they helped put us in this crisis and prolonged it. And indeed, it is fear. People are very, very afraid right now. And John McCain's goal and only goal is to make them more afraid. And so by using the famous Roosevelt line, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself," the answer is America. The only thing you don't play these politics of fear. Fear got us to go into a war that has ruined our economy and solved nothing. You know, fear has gotten us to take away our civil liberties, to trash our Constitution. That we do have to fear. We have to fear fear itself. And I just think that harkening back to those days can make – I mean, you know, Roosevelt was new that at that time. I mean, here's a guy. He's in a wheelchair. And people say, well, that doesn't matter. We've got an economic crisis. We need some help. And I just think that's where we are today. We're in 1932 all over again.
Yeah, right now we have Herbert Hoover in the office. And,
that's exactly right.
You know, the name eludes me, actually, who ran against FDR. I'm only 20.
Herbert Hoover! Hoover!
Well, he did run.
Hoover had the audacity to run for re-election in 1932. Can you believe it?
For some reason, I thought he didn't seek re-election. I guess I'm confusing him somehow with Lyndon Johnson, but...
No, Johnson didn't seek re-election. Johnson was a smarter politician than Herbert Hoover.
Yeah, he realized he created a big mess and decided it was time to go.
Right. It still didn't help. His party lost. Right,
Yeah, I mean, heck, I was born the last year of Jimmy Carter, so basically I haven't seen the good times for the Democratic Party. But
it was a very different Democratic Party then. When Jimmy Carter is the last time that the Democrats held both houses and – well, that's not true. Actually, Clinton – I take that back. Clinton was president, and for 2 years the Democrats held both houses, but they held it by tiny, tiny margins. The last time the Democrats had a substantial margin was in Carter's era, but it was a very different time because at that time there were two Democratic parties. The Democratic Party was in transition. I'm sure you know that prior to the 1960s, the Republicans were the parties of civil rights, the party of Abraham Lincoln, and the Democrats were the party of the white Southerner. Democrats have always looked out for the poor, but at the time, you know, based on Lincoln and all, the abolitionists were connected with business and everything like that. So the segregationists in the 50s were the Democrats, and that started to change with Lyndon Johnson and John Kennedy and the Civil Rights Act. But by the 70s, there were still a number of conservative Democrats left in the party. And so Carter never had a progressive majority. He had a Democratic majority, but didn't have a progressive majority. Many of the conservative Democrats were joining with conservative Republicans, and that's why I think one of the reasons he seems so ineffective as president. Hey, Spike, I got to go. I got another caller on the line, but I really appreciate your calling. I hope you're calling again sometime.
Yes, definitely. Well, now I'm unemployed. I got all the time in the world. I just want to.
Oh, I'm one sorry to hear that.
I heard.
Go ahead. Make your one last thing. Go ahead.
Yeah, there was a poll that came out today. I think it was Survey USA did it. Has Obama 55, McCain 40 in the state of Pennsylvania. So just for people who are wondering where Pennsylvania is going, that's the latest I've heard as of this afternoon.
To be fair, I think that's an outlier. I think that he's about 9 to 10 points up in Pennsylvania, which is fine. That's all we need. The 15 points, that's a little optimistic. I mean, you can always take sort of the most optimistic polls, and really the fairest way is to sort of average them down the middle. But, hey, 9 points in Pennsylvania, I'm okay with that. I'm not worried about Pennsylvania. At this point, All he has to do is really hold Colorado or Virginia or Florida or Ohio, and right now he's holding them all. So, you know, we're doing good. But don't be complacent. Get people out to vote in Pennsylvania. Thanks for your call. I appreciate it. Let me go to Kevin in Brooklyn. Kevin, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
How you doing?
I'm doing good. What are your thoughts?
I'm doing okay. I'm ecstatic, you know, seeing McCain's campaign crumble in front of his. When you have
it's good, but I'm afraid. I'm nervous. I don't want to get too ecstatic. I'm like, you know, it sounds good, you know, but it's not done yet. No. It's not done. You know, it's like when you get a job and you hear like they're probably going to offer you the job, but you haven't gotten it yet. I'm nervous. Yeah. Tonight, things could change. Obama's very smooth, but he could make one slip that suddenly I don't know. I don't want to pop the champagne corks too soon. I'm actually afraid we're doing so well, if that makes any sense.
I am too, because, you know, October isn't over yet, and there's still a surprise to be had.
Well, you know, it's just the first week of October, so, they're going to bring out everything. He's flailing.
October.
He's flailing. I mean, when they start bringing in William Ayers, you know they're desperate. Tonight, I think, is very important. I hope everyone watches very closely what happens tonight.
Definitely will be tuned in. It's just that, I don't know, it's like he doesn't have a point to stand on. He really doesn't. And, you know, what's her name? Caribou Barbie isn't really helping any.
Well, you know, I forgot, and I can't get credit for this because I'm trying to remember who created the name. I like calling her the She-Bush. Because that's what she is. She's the She-Bush.
I think Bob invented that.
Oh, maybe Bob did. I'm sorry. Okay. I'll give my co-host on the horn a credit where credit is due. If he did the She-Bush. I mean, I called her Cheney with a dress. I think I get credit for that one. But it's the same idea. This is a woman who hates the law. She was asked about Cheney as vice president, about the role of a vice president, and she said, well, I just love that the Constitution gives us flexibility to expand the role as much as possible. And, you know, pundits didn't comment much on that. I think it's because they thought she was too stupid to believe what she's saying. But you can be stupid and still grasp for power. You can be ignorant and still want as much power as possible. And what she said was she thinks that the vice president is, well, like Cheney said, above the law, not a member of the executive branch, not a member of the legislative branch. He gets all the powers of both and all the restrictions of neither, which is Cheney's position.
Oh, yeah. Which scares me, you know, because what's scarier than Cheney being vice president is her being vice president, literally.
I don't know. it's some choice to make. I don't know whether I want an evil, intelligent power monger or whether I want an evil, ignorant power monger. I don't know. It's kind of a hard choice.
You gotta add certain factors onto Palin. She's one of these end of days Christians who, you know, and don't forget, at least George Bush is healthy. George Bush was healthy, so there was no...
Right. John McCain has melanoma, and he's had it three times.
And, you know, that we still question... She is literally a heartbeat away from the presidency.
You know,
that scares me.
And I got to tell you, it is scaring other people, too. I walked around Virginia neighborhoods all last weekend, and, you know, the Democrats, they were easy. And the independents are actually fairly easy, too. I had a lot of good conversations with Republicans. Now, to be fair, I mean, the great majority of Republicans were going for John McCain. But any Republican that was willing to talk with me, they were undecided. And one of the things they most brought up was Sarah Palin. And they saw it.
Yeah.
I was going to say, they saw it not just as, you know, I'm worried that McCain may die and Palin may be president, but also as a sign of McCain's erratic judgment. That here's the first, quote, presidential, unquote, decision he made, and he chose her, someone solely for political reasons. Oh, I didn't know John McCain was like that. He's not the John McCain I thought I knew. I thought John McCain was above politics. I mean, these are what the Republicans told me. I used to have a lot of respect for John McCain. These are the kinds of things I'm hearing, and it's fascinating because he's going to go really, really negative tonight. And I'll be curious to know if other Republicans start saying things like, huh, I used to respect John McCain, but I don't recognize him anymore.
Well, the thing is with John McCain, and he really, really needs to end this stuff called the maverick nonsense, because he's been in the same job for 26 years. You're no maverick. You're no outsider. You're as inside as they come.
Did you see the Saturday Night Live episode?
Which one?
Last Saturday. The last Saturday night where they did the vice presidential debate.
Oh, yeah. That was hilarious.
Yeah, and Tina Fey at the end says, and for those of you playing the drinking game, Maverick.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
What do we to think of a country where I think 40 million people watch the presidential debate and 70 million watch the vice presidential debate, the highest watched vice presidential debate in American history?
Well, the thing is, it's an entertainment factor, and this country has been overfed and over-entertained while the empire around it crumbles. And that's
Nero did fiddle while Rome burned. It's always nice to hear a good fiddle.
Yeah, you know, and this is what's happening. And people, you know, people still vote more on American Idol than they do in their elections. So, you know.
To be fair to my fellow American citizens, you can vote more than once on American Idol. You know, that statistic always bugs me because I don't believe it's true. Correct me if I'm wrong. If you got a statistic, you know, I'll read it, Kevin. But I don't believe that more numbers of people do vote on American Idol. I think more votes are cast. So I'll defend my statement
that
way. Because they can vote twice. Of course, you know, in some places in Chicago, you know, Mayor Daley, supposedly you can vote twice. So I don't know. But
but it's just the fact that people pay attention more to American Idol than the politics.
Well, many do. And the scary thing is that the undecided voters, the ones who still don't know who they're voting for, and there's still probably a good 8% of Americans that are still undecided, they're the ones who know the least about politics. And they're the ones that John McCain's going to play for with his negative advertising.
Yeah. I don't
know that it's enough. As long as Obama stays at 50% or above in the popular vote, I'm confident he will pick up all the electoral votes he needs. In fact, he could probably do it with, you know, 49.5.
The thing is, it's just, you know, I have a friend. She claims she's not really into politics. She's very apolitical or what have you. And she recently, her boss advised her because of the whole credit thing, that her check is going to be late. I said, see why you need to pay attention to politics?
Yeah, there you go.
And she's going to be basically living off of her credit card for the next month.
I'm wondering, well, and then this country's been living off its credit card for the last 8 years. I'm wondering, no, because under Bill Clinton, we had a good 5 years of surpluses. So it's not true the last 30. It's true the last 30 except for Bill Clinton. But no, I mean, I remember, it's hard to imagine, but there was a time in 2000 when I don't know why his name escapes me right now. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan. God, I guess I wanted to forget him. Alan Greenspan actually testified in Congress in 2001 in support of the Bush tax cuts. I remember this because I was there. That he was afraid that we would have so many surpluses as far as the eye could see that we would pay off the entire national debt, and then it would be hard to know where to put the extra money, and therefore we needed the tax cuts. And I remember at that time, you know, laughing and thinking, let's cross that bridge when we come to it, Alan. All right, let's pay off the national debt. And then if we've paid it off entirely and then you want tax cuts for the rich, fine. Fine by me. But you know, let's pay it. He actually made that silly argument.
And you know what's so weird? And the American public expect to get a fair shake on the news because, you know, him and Andrea Mitchell have been, you know, intimate companions for the past 20-some-odd years.
I believe they're husband and wife.
They are husband and wife now. But it's like I can never expect to get a fair shake on the news. You know, people talk about how NBC is the most – it's infotainment.
Well, a lot of the news is
a whole incestuous pool of reporters and politicians in D.C.
There are, but I'm not going to throw out the baby with the bathwater. There are some – that I respect, that say wise things. I look at people like Jeffrey Toobin or Fareed Zakaria or Christiane Amanpour. I mean, there's some names I can throw out there of people I respect. You know, But you're right. There's certainly plenty of the other kind.
Yeah. All I know, Joe Scarborough is an ass. That's all I know.
Well, Joe Scarborough was a member, a Republican member of the Judiciary Committee when I was there. I know Joe Scarborough.
Yeah, he's an ass.
Yeah, here you have an ex-Republican congressman. You know, I don't know of any ex-Democratic members of Congress anywhere in the media. I'm just trying to think. Are there any?
None.
Pat Buchanan ran for president. Mario Cuomo, there aren't any. I can't think of any.
And Harold Ford.
But he's on TV, is he?
He's part-time.
He's a commentator, but he doesn't have his own show or anything like that.
No.
Frankly, I don't even see him as a regular commentator. I've seen him very rarely. I think he's on less than...
He's gearing up to run for senator again now.
Yeah, I think he probably is. You know, it's funny. Howard Ford, I mean, it's hard. I mean, he's actually fairly conservative for a Democrat, but, you know, he's from D.C., so that may be what you have to do.
Yeah.
Hey, Kevin, thanks for your call. Always appreciate you calling.
No problem, buddy. Okay.
Let me just close. And there's still time for one more call if you want to call in at 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. I want, though, just to talk about the debate tonight and just the feelings of it's hard to know. It's hard as a Democrat to contemplate winning. And it makes me nervous. You know, Barack Obama did stunningly well when he was behind in the primaries. Stunningly well. Iowa, and then he ran off on Super Tuesday, and then the weeks thereafter. And then he started pulling ahead, and everyone said he was the front runner. And, well, that's when Hillary pulled out, right? The Reverend Wright and the William Ayer stuff, and he kind of collapsed a bit, kind of limped over the finish line. Now, I actually think that Hillary Clinton did Barack Obama a favor. I don't think many Obama supporters thought so at the time. But by raising these things in March, I think the public doesn't want to hear about it. We're going to watch tonight. John McCain is going to pull out all stops. You're going to hear a lot about William Ayers. And it's going to be hard because the people in the town hall are going to be wanting to know about the economy. They're going to want to know about health care. They want to know about their jobs. They want to know about this bailout. They want to know about inflation. And John McCain is going to want to talk about a domestic terrorist 40 years ago who sat on a board with Barack Obama and once had Obama in his home, even though they haven't talked in years. And I hope that the people at the town hall meeting will get mad at McCain and say, well, Senator, hello, we got an economic meltdown and you want to talk about William Ayers? But it's not easy for them to do. The format of the debate tonight requires that each of the people in the audience submit their questions in advance to Tom Brokaw, who chooses the questions. It happens to be in my hometown of Nashville, Tennessee. And the way they're doing it is the Gallup poll has called 150 Middle Tennesseans, and only the undecided people, only people who have not decided between Obama or McCain, are invited to attend the debate. I'll tell you a funny story. I had just read that to my mom over the phone. I told her the story. And my father then came and said, hey, I just got a phone call from the Gallup organization. I told him I was for Obama. And we said, Dad, how could you do that? My dad lives in Tennessee. It was the Gallup poll. They were the ones who made this. If my father had simply said undecided, he might have been able to ask a question at the town hall meeting, but he didn't know, and I don't know if that's fair anyway, because, you know, you're supposed to be legitimately undecided. So I guess it's just as fine as well that my father told the truth to the Gallup poll, but he could have been one asking the questions. In any event, Tom Brokaw, in some sense, gets to ask the questions because you've got, you know, 100 people submitting questions, and I think about 20% go on the Internet. So, folks, if you got a good, tough question, you should be able to look up a way to you can submit the question yourself. But at the end of the day, it's you know, Tom Brokaw gets to choose among the questions. And what's interesting is that the questioners are not allowed any follow-up, and their mic is cut as soon as they ask the question. And I believe there's even an agreement not to show reaction shots. But I don't know how can they do that with cameras? I would think the cameras would have to show the reaction shot. That could be the kicker, right? the voter's reaction, the person, you know, giving a furrowed brow. That'd be great, but I don't know that that's allowed. They're trying to make it as careful as possible. And you know what? I don't really like it as an American, as someone who believes that politicians should answer questions, but as an Obama supporter, I just don't see how it changes anything. And that's okay. Right? McCain needs a home run. I mean, there's two outs, and he's behind by 6 points. He's got to get those guys on bases and around, and he's got to get some good hits. And with a format like that, it just doesn't seem to be game-changing. So Obama will go negative. Excuse me. McCain will go negative. Obama will go negative in response to McCain's going negative. And the question will be whether voters understand that it's John McCain who threw the first punch. When McCain brought up, and actually Palin, the she-bush, as it were, or Caribou Barbie, whatever you want to call her, when Palin brought up the Obama's ties with heirs, ties is such a bad word. His association, his acquaintanceship. I'll accept acquaintanceship. Of course, they haven't spoken in several years. The fact that he knows of the man, I don't know, what do you say? But when Palin brought up the fact that, she called them ties between Obama and heirs, did people understand what's really going on here? See, I think the American people, as much as we criticize them for, as Kevin said, voting more for American Idol than voting for the presidency, I think they're more sophisticated than others think they are. The American people saw right through John McCain's, I'm going to drop everything and go save Washington on the bailout bill. I'm not going to attend the debate until the bill is done. Oh, the bill's not done? Oh, the debate's now? Okay. Indeed, that was the beginning of what took a very tight race and started pointing it toward Obama. In fact, they're pretty much neck and neck. McCain may even have been slightly ahead when that happened. John McCain is a flailing, erratic, gambling, angry man. And it's fascinating because his planned strategy, the one he's announced in advance that he's going to do, is to go negative, gambling at the last minute, because he's so far behind in the polls, even though he said he wouldn't do so. Gambling, erratic, angry. And that's the voters' perception of him. Now, how the heck can he go negative without seeming angry? I mean, I guess he'll stare at Barack Obama more. I mean, that's one of the things that people pointed out in the analysis, of course, right? That Barack Obama would look at John McCain. John McCain wouldn't even look at Barack Obama. Well, he'll stare at him. But it's hard. It's hard to insult someone to their face when you really don't believe it. And the funny thing is that because of the collegial atmosphere in the Senate, where everybody calls themselves by everybody's first name, it's even harder. When I watched the first debate and I saw Barack Obama refer to John McCain as John, and John McCain never did. He never said Barack once. He said, you know, Senator Obama. At first, I thought it was a mistake. At first, I thought that kind of familiarity seemed informal. It would have been wrong, obviously wrong, for Joe Biden to at any time refer to Governor Sarah Palin as Sarah. That would be seen immediately as sexist and condescending and all of that stuff. But somehow, at first, it bothered me. At first, I was like, why is Obama calling him John? But then I realized that familiarity works. Familiarity may breed contempt. Obama calls him John. Joe Biden calls him John. And when they do so, it's not disrespect because everyone knows they do know the man. In fact, it makes it clear they know the man very well. And when Joe Biden says John, even more when Biden says it because he's been around a lot longer, but also when Barack Obama says it, it's like, oh, you crazy old angry uncle. John. Somehow that just seems less off-putting than Senator McCain. Because it's a way of saying, I understand that you're making all this stuff up just because you're losing an election. I get it, John. I get it. You're not an evil man, John McCain. You're just someone who's willing to do anything to win. And we all understand that. And we'll pat you on the head. And then we'll give you a medal for your service and tell you to, you know, go back to the Senate. And it's exactly the right way to respond. If Obama were to respond with anger, or were to respond with, you know, John McCain is evil, some of the things that I think are quite appropriate with people like Dick Cheney, it wouldn't ring with the American people. It might ring with the left. But it wouldn't ring with the middle undecided voters. By saying John is a good man, but he's wrong, that just says it perfectly. In other words, we're good people. We, Obama and Biden, we don't attack personally. Biden says, I kind of like the man. Obama was saying, John's right about this, that, or the other, but wrong about this, that, and that. And at the time, I remember thinking, wow, that's not typical debate strategy. In fact, John McCain stupidly ran an ad right after debate where they showed all the times that Obama said John's right. Very stupid. Because it made Obama seem reasonable. Obama's willing to work across the aisle. Obama's willing to talk with people he disagrees with. Obama says John's right about this, but he's wrong about that. Obama is the epitome of a reasonable guy. Someone you can deal with. Someone who can talk across the aisle. Someone who can talk reasonably. Someone who doesn't get angry. Barack Obama is cool. He's cool. He's collected. He's not angry. He doesn't fly off the handle. And let's face it, a lot of white people's racism is based on this fear of the angry black man. And in this race, there is no angry black man. There's a very angry white man. And he's scaring a lot of people. President Barack Obama, and it's such a pleasure to say that. President Obama, think about what it means for American history. President Obama will, I think, be one of the great presidents. He will take anything that happens, and listen, sometimes you can only be great because you're dealt awful times, and he's coming into power, if he's elected, when he's elected, at one of the most awful times in American history. So he will have his chance to shine. And I believe that President Obama will do as president what he's done throughout this election. If there's a problem, if there's a consideration, he'll listen to a lot of people from all walks of life, from all points of view, and make a cool, calm, collected, reasonable, intelligent decision. And I hope tonight we see this President Obama on the stage, and I think we will. That's all for the Inside Scoop. Tomorrow we'll be talking about the debate, what you thought about it, what I thought about it. For now, waiting for your Hillbilly Elitist coming up next. This is Mark Levine signing off.